Welcome to Rails with Jason. I'm Jason Sweat. A quick word before today's episode. If you're a Rails developer, there's a good chance you're writing tests. If you want to get better at writing tests, or if you're not currently writing tests and you want to learn how, go to codewithjason.com where you can find my free Ruby testing micro course. Now on to the episode. Welcome to the Rails with Jason podcast. I'm Jason Sweat, and I'm here today with Trey Robrock. Trey and I used to work together for a little over a year, maybe a year and a half, and now we're here to talk about debugging tips, because when I worked with Trey, I found that he was really good at debugging, and I think I'm pretty good at debugging, and I see a lot of people making a lot of mistakes when it comes to debugging. So we're here to kind of say, hey, here are some of the tactics we use that let us debug stuff quickly and efficiently. But before we get into that stuff, Trey, do you want to introduce yourself to our listeners?
Sure. Yeah. Thanks for having me on. So I'm Trey. I'm one of the founders of Greenbits. We build point of sale software in the cannabis space, which is how Jason and I came to work together. What was it, like a year or two ago now? Mm-hmm. I've been doing Rails since the beginning of my career about 10 years ago. Outright.com, small business accounting software at GoDaddy, and now small business at Greenbits. So small business Rails stuff is really all I've done.
Yeah. Yeah, same here. A lot of my Rails experience has been like back office stuff, where it's like a Rails application that just faces internal users. So I've dealt with scaling to 10 users and stuff like that. But then obviously, like at Greenbits, we did a lot more scaling than that, because that was kind of a not public facing, but B2B and kind of relatively high volume.
Yeah, definitely. It's by far probably one of the largest scale systems I've worked on.
Yeah, and that's a whole different topic, scaling to more than just a few users. Okay, so kind of where I got this idea is like, well, at this very moment, I'm in Detroit, Michigan, Hamtramck, Michigan specifically, but I'm here to teach a class. I'm teaching this 5-week class. The students are all recent computer science graduates. And so we're working together in person, and I'm like sitting over their shoulder helping them debug stuff. And there's just a bunch of little stuff like, and this isn't just these students in this class. This is like students in previous years of this class. And like I teach all over the world, and people make these same mistakes in a lot of the classes I've been to. And these aren't just beginner things, like really experienced people make these mistakes too. So I made a list, and I figured me and Trey could just go through these lists, this list, and talk about these things. I'll list it in the show notes, but if you Google Jason Sweat programming tips, it should be the first thing that comes up. So here are the tips. The first one is articulate the problem. So what I wrote here is, if you can precisely articulate what the problem is, you've already gone a good ways toward the solution. And if you can't articulate what the problem is, I don't see how you could really even have any hope of achieving what you want to achieve, because how can you achieve what you want to achieve if you don't know what you're trying to achieve? So Trey, do you have anything to add to that one?
I'm glad that you put this at the top of the list, because that is probably one of the biggest things that end up like sucking a ton of time is someone comes to you and says, hey, there's this bug and you can't do blah. And then your next question is like, okay, but can you do X? And they're like, oh yeah, I don't know. So mm-hmm. like, it's this big, broad thing until you narrow it down to a smaller thing and actually know what the actual problem is. Like, the problem is not a customer can't make a sale. The problem is a customer can't make a sale when they've attached a customer and the tax rate is set to blah.
Exactly. Yeah, so you have to nail down the scope of the problem. Obviously, like reproduction steps are really helpful. And not just helpful for somebody else to communicate to you how to reproduce it, but I actually go so far as to write it down. Like, here is exactly what's going wrong. And I make sure to only state what I know to be true. There's a passage in that book, Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, that talks about this. And it's like, he's talking about if you're fixing a motorcycle and something, let's say the motorcycle won't start. If you write down like the motorcycle won't start because there's a problem with the electrical system, but you don't know for an absolute fact that the problem lies in the electrical system, then you're starting off with a bad premise and you're probably going to waste time. And he says in the book that it's better just to state problem, cycle won't start. Which sounds dumb, but that's better because you're only writing the bare minimum that you know.
That's interesting. Yeah, I've never tied debugging software back to mechanic work, but I'm a big gearhead myself, and like that's very true. When my Jeep doesn't start, I don't assume where it is, because when I do, I take a ton of time elsewhere.
Yeah. So that's number one there. Articulate the problem. The next one I have on my list here is don't fall into logical fallacies. So I'm not going to read off my whole thing here, but basically the idea behind this one is it's related to what we just said, which is don't trick yourself into thinking you know things you don't actually know. And this is the difference between this and the one we just said is like, the thing we just went over was like a problem statement. And this has to do with, as you're debugging, you're investigating and you're collecting facts. You're saying, when I do this, this, and this, I get this result. But when I do this, this, and this, I get this other result. And so there's kind of maybe two layers to it. There's like the experiments that you conduct, and then you can record the results of those experiments. That's pretty safe because you're just making observations. It's hard to be wrong about that. But then you need to be a little more careful about drawing conclusions, because you don't want to trick yourself into drawing a conclusion that's invalid. Do you have anything to add to that one, Trey?
Yeah, whenever I hear this one, I think a lot of like the times when someone's brought me a new problem and I'm like, oh, I know exactly what that is. I never know exactly what that is. Mm-hmm. But like you want to look like the smart person that knows exactly how to solve the problem and exactly how long it's going to take. And that's just almost never the case.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's very true. I had an instance of this today. In this class, we had a guest speaker, and we've been having all kinds of problems with connecting people's laptops to our display in the room. And so this guy was giving his talk and the screen went dark and he like started messing with his computer. And I'm like, oh no, it's probably just the connection. Cause like in all the cases before that, it was just the HDMI cable was like loose or something like that. I'm like, oh, it's probably just the cable. But his computer had like fallen asleep. And so he was like, he had to log back in again. So it wasn't the cable. And by jumping to that conclusion and saying it out loud in front of everybody, I looked dumb because I was wrong. So that's what you get when you jump to conclusions like that.
Yeah, exactly.
Usually though, it's, I don't know, maybe that captures it. Maybe it's a little more subtle, but I definitely observe people a lot who are trying to debug something. They'll say, oh, I see this happening, and over here I see this other thing happening, and therefore this other thing must be true.
Yeah.
And so it's like, I recently bought a couple books on like logic and epistemology to try to get even better at like figuring out what's true. And I think it's just like there's rules of logic. If you know that all, I can't come up with an example, but all they use like made up words, you know?
Uh-huh.
All snuts are I can't come up with fake words right now for some reason, but you know the kind of thing I'm talking about, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And so like, don't go outside those rules of logic, because then you're not on safe footing anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think you're making a good point. I've seen it a ton of times where you'll start digging into a problem, you'll see two symptoms and you convince yourself that they're related, but you haven't proven to yourself that they're related. Like you haven't traced up the object tree to see how one interacts with the other. And they may, like, oftentimes when you do that, you actually identify two entirely independent bugs rather than one joint bug.
Yeah. Yeah. And it is true that you can make safe assumptions. There's such thing as a safe assumption. But it's important to make a distinction in your mind between, right now I'm making a pretty safe assumption, and the other thing, which is I have just observed an absolute fact.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Okay, I think that's probably good for that one. Ooh, this next one is one of my favorites.
I'm really excited about this next one.
Yeah, favorite isolation over reason. So there's kind of two ways in my mind of pinpointing a bug. One way is to scratch your head and stare at the screen and be like, what's going on here, and think really hard. And the other is just to find out where and when did this bug get introduced. And then it's usually like, oh, in this commit, it was this line that got changed. Let's just change that back. And now it's fixed.
Yes. And like, I don't know why, but what I feel like I see a lot is when a bug is introduced, somehow people like to believe that it was created out of nothing.
Okay.
And like, so like the behavior is always that of which like some gremlin in the code created this thing out of nothing, rather than the assumption that a commit was written and developed by an engineer and put in and created this thing. So the approach is like you said, like scratching your head, looking at the code, rather than just going back to figuring out when it actually broke.
That's really interesting. It never occurred to me that somebody could think that a bug got introduced any other way than a person committing code that introduced that bug.
Yeah. And I don't know if people actually think that. That's how the behavior always reads to me. Like I like that you call out git bisect in here, but the lack of use of git bisect to me just indicates this exactly. Mm-hmm. Like that is one of my favorite tools of all tools I have to use.
Let's talk about that. So git bisect, in case the listener is unfamiliar, you have a feature. Let's even come up with a concrete example. Let's say that I have a customer form where I can just update the customer's profile, click mm-hmm. save, and it saves the changes. A month ago, that feature worked fine, and that feature worked fine every day for a long time. But then today, the feature no longer works, and you don't know why. So I can use git bisect to say, I know that today it doesn't work. I know that a month ago it worked as of this particular commit, but I don't know where in time that bug was introduced. So git bisect, it's called bisect because it bisects the set of changes between the good commit and the bad commit that you've specified, cuts it in half and says, okay, let's go halfway in between a month ago and today. Let's check now. So it'll check out that commit in the middle for you. And you can go manually, or if you have an automated test for it, you can check, does this feature work at this commit? If it does, then you can say git bisect good. If it doesn't, you can say git bisect bad. And let's say you say that it was good. So to make it easy to talk about, let's say 4 weeks ago, the feature worked. Today it doesn't work. 2 weeks ago, the feature still worked. So we can rule out everything between 4 weeks ago and 2 weeks ago. We know that it was good during that time, so the bug lies in this most recent half, the most recent 2 weeks. Then you just repeat that until you find the bug, and just like mathematically, it works out, so it never takes that many steps to find it.
Mm-hmm. And this is something I've spent a lot of time building tooling on top of Git Bisect, because like you said, you can run automated tests to bisect. I've never once in my life ran a bisect manually. I always write some sort of script that writes the tests, runs database migrations, sets up the bundle and all of this stuff. And then you just run it, and then you go play a game of ping pong and you come back, and then you can sit down with the person that wrote the bad commit and fix the bug.
Oh, wow. I've never, not never, but I've only done that like once.
So yeah, I have.
That's like your go-to.
Yeah, I have a script called gbisect.sh in my home directory that is my script that I write into whenever I need to run a test on something.
If it's easy for you, you should like put that in a gist and give me the link, and I can put that in the show notes.
Yeah, definitely. I pair that with some of the tools that Hub adds onto Git. But yeah, when you mix those two together, it's really simple. And I think that script calls out some of the gotchas. Like most of it's around like on a Rails project, you know, database migrations or bundle install, and then making sure that those don't fail. And it's kind of like whenever you're trying to isolate the bug, like you don't want to run the whole test suite every time. You want just the one simple thing that fails every mm-hmm. single time. But for the most part, it works wonderfully. That's why that tool is my favorite, because I can find, you know, most good commits are small. They're a few lines long. Maybe the bisect takes 30 minutes. Normally doesn't even take that to run. And then you've narrowed your multi-thousand line code base down to two lines of code that broke
mm-hmm.
without doing anything.
Which is so much easier than trying to use Reason to find the introduction.
Exactly.
And,
yeah.
And you said something important there. You said like, if your commits are small, then this is easy. And that's so true. If your commits are small, it's easy. If your commits are big, it's a lot harder. So that's
an advantage. I mean, if you're only committing once a week in your 4 week example, like you've still narrowed it down to 1 week's worth of code. But if you were committing every 30 minutes, every hour, or whatever made sense in chunks. Oh, the other thing I would point out with Git Bisect is it's very important that your commits are done things, are runnable things. Mm-hmm. Work in progress commits make Bisect very difficult to use.
Yeah. And work in progress, I'm just really not a fan of work in progress commits in general.
I believe that's what Stash was created for.
Yeah. And let's see if we can articulate, Trey, why are work in progress commits? Why is that bad?
So for me, a big driver of me not liking work in progress commits is because of my love of Git Bisect.
Fair enough.
Like I believe you should be able to check out any commit in the code forever and it runs.
Yeah.
Like maybe there was a bug, but there wasn't like missing code that you knew that wasn't going to work.
Mm-hmm.
Like every commit, and also like my DevOps background, like you want every commit to be deployable. You should be able to roll back to anything, and it should just be easy to move around the tree of your Git history and still run the code and test the code.
Yeah. And it's like if you commit a commit that's partially done and maybe it breaks the test suite or it just breaks functionality, then your next commit has to like get you back on the path. And that's not good. I don't want to have like that hanging responsibility to have the next commit address the previous unfinished commit.
Yeah. And Git provides so many tools around it. Like I do work in progress commits. Like if you're, you know, I work with one of my coworkers and need to push something so that he can work on it in hours that I'm not around, like he'll work on that, but then just rebase it later.
Mm-hmm. Wait.
Anyways, we could do like a whole conversation on Git.
Yeah, let's just tie that up real quick. You say you rebase it later. That's not what I expected you to say. I expected you to say that like maybe you'll work on a branch and you're doing it. If you commit something that's partial, you might squash it before you merge it into master.
I'm one of the few that's not a big fan of squash and merge.
Okay.
Partially because it results in those very large commits.
Yeah.
It makes it really easy to have very large commits, especially like, you know, the engineering organizations I've been a part of, like it's pretty typical to have a branch last multiple weeks. Mm. So then you have multiple weeks being squashed into one.
That's bad.
A lot of times I like to just rebase the things that I know that I can rebase.
That makes sense. So yeah, let's wrap that part up. And just to attach some terms to that, some of the things we were talking about are known as atomic commits and continuous delivery. Continuous delivery mm-hmm. is when you always have something ready to go.
Yep.
Okay. So that was favor isolation over reason. The next one is a similar idea. Favor Googling over thinking. What do you think about always. This one, Trey?
Always. Like I always say, like our job as engineers is not to create new concepts and new ways of doing things. It's just to take everything that people have done before and piece it together in new and creative ways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think like this is the same thing. I think if you run into a bug that has never been seen before, that is highly unlikely. And you're doing some really crazy stuff.
Yeah. And when I find myself in situations where I'm getting a bug that I can't find the answer to online, I step back and ask myself, kind of like you just said, what kind of crazy situation did I get myself into? Maybe I shouldn't be in this place, you know?
Uh-huh.
Maybe the answer is not to fix this error I'm getting. Maybe the answer is to take 10 steps back and start again at a further up place in my path and try a different path.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I have a good example of that, something I'm working on right now. So I'm working on a system that's doing image processing, but it's doing it within Docker containers. And I was running into this error that, awesomely enough, didn't actually have an error message. And I couldn't find anyone talking about not having an error message. So it caused me to step back and think about, like, how are people using this in the real world today? And how am I using it? And the core difference was my Docker container. Turns out my Docker container didn't have enough memory. And whenever it got killed for no memory, it just gave me no error.
Got it. So how did you ultimately get past that?
Gave it more memory.
Oh, well, there you go. So a big part of why I believe in favor Googling overthinking is because you have a certain like finite amount of mental energy in a day. At least I do. Trey, based on the amount I've seen you work, I'm not sure that that's true of you.
I definitely do.
But you get more tired as the day goes on. And, you know, people say, like, there's only 24 hours in a day. I wish I had more time. I don't wish I had more time. I wish I had more mental energy. Because I run out of mental energy way before I run out of time in the day. And yep. So I try to think of whatever I can do to preserve that mental energy is good. I'm not going to waste my time thinking about low-level stuff like, oh, I got this error message. I don't know what it means. Let me go educate myself about the internals of Linux so that I can find... No, I'm just going to Google it and the first Stack Overflow answer that there is, I'll just try it. And if it fixes it, I can move on. And I think there's a time and place for not thinking that way. There's a time for saying, okay, I should understand the things that I'm working with. That's definitely, you know, if somebody argued that, I wouldn't disagree. So I think the skill there is like being judicious about when you recognize this is a time when I should deeply understand what I'm working with. This is a time when a superficial fix is the right thing so I can get back to the thing I'm trying to finish.
Yeah, definitely. As you described that, it reminds me of like, the whole difference between efficiency and efficacy. Like you could be really efficient at going through your email, but that might not be the most effective way to spend your time. Mm. Like you could be really good at learning about the low levels of Linux and the details behind a crash, but that's probably not the most effective way to spend your time and the way to conserve mental energy.
Yeah. Yeah. I definitely know what you mean. I read a little bit about this in the book, The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. He talks about doing things right versus doing the right things. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So that is favor Googling over thinking. This next one is an interesting one. Learning how to formulate good search queries for error messages. This one drives me absolutely insane when I watch mm-hmm. people do it, because they'll get an error message and then they'll copy and paste so much into Google. And I'm like, wait a second, that has like your path of your unique home directory in it. and all this stuff that's like certainly unique to this particular situation. No one has ever Googled that before. You're very unlikely to get good results that way. And then the other end of the extreme is you copy and paste something that's too small, so your search results are going to be so broad that the solutions you get are going to have a low likelihood of matching up to your problem. Mm-hmm. So there's a skill in, you know, with error messages in particular, finding the right scope of stuff to copy and paste into Google. But then aside from that, just like the skill of formulating good queries. And I'm not sure how to articulate that, but what do you have to say about that stuff, Train?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, it's definitely one of the biggest challenges. And something that I'd add to this is the importance of like listing out the frameworks and versions that you use. Mm. Like Rails, for example. You know, I've been doing a lot of active storage stuff lately, and active storage in 6 and 5.2 handle image variations very differently. So the version numbers there matter a lot, and there's starting to become a lot of libraries that have the same name across like Python and Node and Ruby. So you'll do a search for, what's a good example of this one? I think Active Model actually has a PHP equivalent. So sometimes you'll do a search for Active Model and it's in PHP, and you're like, well, that doesn't really help me much. Mm-hmm. So I think that's an additional piece that's really important. But I think like your software engineers, right? So thinking about how you would have built a naive search engine to parse this thing, mm-hmm. and then give it that.
Yeah, I try to think of what have other people probably Googled before me. Because mm-hmm. it's like I'm trying to reproduce the Google searches of previous developers before me, because I want to find the same thing they found.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think along mm-hmm. those lines, like lean into the autocomplete results that Google gives you.
Yeah. Yeah, because it's like there is a well-trodden path probably, and you're trying to find that well-trodden path and follow it. So my next one here is, don't give too much credence to the error message. It's another common mistake of people seeing an error message and assuming that it's a reasonable assumption, but people assume that the error message has something to do with what's actually wrong. But rarely is that the case, unfortunately. Usually the error message has no relationship with the actual problem. The most useful part of the error message, I find, is the line number. So I'll just go straight to the line number without even paying much attention to what the error message is. And usually it'll be immediately obvious. Oh, I have like a parentheses mismatch or whatever. So that's that one. What do you think about that one, Trey?
Yeah, I think that makes sense. I think additionally, like paying attention to the error and understanding when that last line number is not in your code. Like I see this a lot too. Sort of like the assumption that like a bug was just created out of nothing. People like to assume for some reason that, oh my God, there's a bug in this framework. It's highly unlikely that there's a bug in any of the frameworks you're using, unless it's like some really random, not used framework. The bug's in your code. Right. So trace that stack trace up to where your code is and figure out how it uses the framework not wrong, not track down the bug in the framework.
That's a good point. Have you seen people trying to like people assuming that the bug exists in the framework?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, wow. I've seen multiple times before, and I don't know if it's like an ego thing or what, but they assume that maybe they're doing something so special that the framework never thought of this. And what I'm talking about frameworks, I'm talking about like things like Active Record, like things that are used by millions of people and millions of applications around the world. Like it's doing its job, you're just using it wrong.
Absolutely. I've been working with Rails since 2011, which as of this recording is about 8 years ago. Very recently, I found my first ever bug in Rails. So in 8 years, never encountered mm-hmm. a bug in Rails. And the thing the bug is in active storage, so relatively new part yep. of Rails. And it's only in Rails 6, which isn't even out yet.
I have to know what this bug is because I'm in the middle of active storage stuff.
I'll describe it real briefly. So in Rails 5, if you have a has many attached on a model. So you can attach any number of files to that record. Let's say you go into your form, you attach, let's just say one file. Let's call it 1.pdf. Then tomorrow you go into that same record and you add a second file, 2.pdf. Mm-hmm. You click save. In Rails 5, after you click save, you end up with what you would expect, which is both 1.pdf and 2.pdf. In Rails 6, if you do all that stuff, it'll blow away 1.pdf and you'll only Perfect. Be left with 2.pdf. Which, crazily enough, is the intended way for that to work in Rails 6.
Interesting.
So for whatever reason, they decided to change that behavior. And if you upgrade from... So here's the bug. The bug is not that behavior happens, because it's supposed to happen, apparently. The bug is that if you upgrade from Rails 5 to Rails 6, it's supposed to preserve the Rails 5 behavior, but it doesn't.
That's okay, interesting. Mm-hmm. Interesting. Okay.
But again, the point is, in 8 years of Rails, I've only encountered that one bug.
Yeah, and like you said, Active Storage is still very new. Like, working with Active Storage is great, but it's very new. The documentation mm-hmm. is sparse. The examples are sparse. So that's less surprising.
Yeah. Yeah. You're probably not going to find a bug in Active Record or something yeah. like that. Okay. These last two tips are kind of like more minor workflow kind of tips, but I think they're important. Make the terminal window big. So this comes up over and over. A student will say, "Hey, Jason, I'm having this issue. Can you come take a look?" And their terminal window is tiny and you can hardly read anything. And it's like, how are you not driven crazy by your own tiny, tiny terminal window? Anything to add to that one, Trey? That's kind of straightforward.
I mean, I think it goes to like spend time on your tools. Like, I've spent a ridiculous amount of time on my terminal setup, the fonts, the colors, the positioning, the keyboard shortcuts. Like, all of that stuff is going to make you a better engineer, but especially make you better at debugging and tracking down issues.
That's something that I've always noticed that you're much better at than I, Trey, is the tooling part of it. Do you have any tips for, like, if you could pick some of the very most impactful things that you've done with your own tools that you use, what are some of those?
I think aliases are the biggest quick win mm-hmm. In the terminal. It's like, so I was pairing with PJ, you know, PJ, one mm-hmm. of our ex coworkers,
Hi, PJ.
Jason's ex coworker, the other day, and I was running a command on my terminal and he's like, "Don't you need to run bundle exec?" I'm like, "Dude, I haven't ran bundle exec in like 4 or 5 years." It drove me so
to BE.
No, I don't run anything. It's a little more advanced than that. Alias to BE is a good first start. What I actually do is I have my alias for bundle install to B, which always installs bin stubs to dot bin. And then I add ./.bin to my path. Mm-hmm. So all of the bundler bin stubs are accessible via my path. So I never have to mm-hmm. run bundle exec.
Man, we could do a whole small episode stuff like that. About this stuff. There's a couple others that I want. Oh yeah. So I use aliases for Git. A lot of people do. Mm-hmm. So like, I've never typed Git status. I type GS.
Right.
GD for Git diff, all that kind of stuff. And also both you and me, last time I checked, are Vim users.
Yes.
That's a huge time saver. Yeah. And it's arguable that typing is not a huge bottleneck because most of your time is spent thinking about what you're typing. But the way I look at it is like, why waste time spending any more typing than you need to?
Yeah, I always liked Vim a lot. Well, the thing that really sold me on Vim was macros. And if you've never experienced Vim macros, then you don't really know the full power of Vim.
Do you make heavy use of macros? Because I use them, but not like maybe once a month.
Probably not. It's not like an everyday thing, maybe not even an every week thing, but when it is, it's a big thing. Mm-hmm. It's like I went and made 80 complex changes in a file that would have taken me forever. Mm-hmm. And other editors have like crazy vertical edit mode that gets most of the way there. But the other day, a coworker of mine and I were working on something and we needed to restructure a YAML file where we needed to change all the keys to uppercase, remove the underscores, get the tabbing correct. I mean, to do it like 62 times or something like that. So I use macros for that. But the other big reason that I've always liked Vim is that it's right there in your terminal. So it's very easy to run terminal. So running tests, running your servers, it's all right there. And then additionally, because of my DevOps background, it's on the server.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think that's how a lot of people get started with it. They're like forced into it because they need a text editor on the command line. And I like the combo of Vim and Tmux. That's even more powerful.
Mm-hmm, me too.
I'll have a left pane where I code and a right pane where I run my tests. And I have a command. There's a plugin. I forget what it's called. But I can run that command and it'll run in the right pane just the test for the line I'm on,
yep.
Or it'll run the whole file, or it'll run the entire suite.
Yeah. I just recently did a whole revamp of my Tmux and Vim configs.
Yeah. Yeah. If you, I have a thing on my Vim setup, like a video on my Vim setup. If you go to, if you just Google like Jason Sweat Vim, you'll probably find that video. Okay, cool. Well, that's probably enough on tools for the moment because we could talk about it all day. Here's the final tip. It's a little anticlimactic because it is kind of a small tip, but it's an important tip. And that tip is to close the tabs that you're not using and you don't need.
And this goes outside of the context of debugging. Like this is just always.
Yeah. And why? Why is that important?
For me, like one, I can see what tabs I have open right now. Like I can read the title of them. When some of my coworkers, like you go to their computer and it's just a bunch of favicons and you're like, I don't even know what that means. It's like 18 different Stack Overflow icons. I don't know which one's which. And then for me, like it just adds like, it's like having a messy desk. Yeah. Like it just adds a lot of like cognitive overhead. Like all exactly. These things that I know are there and I need to do something with at some point. It's like leaving emails open or text messages open because I need to respond to them later. Like I try to get really good at driving those into my to-do list and my notebook.
Mm-hmm. My heart rate just, like, is clears actually, your head out. My heart rate is increasing as we speak because I'm thinking of all these, just like these last few weeks as I've been working with my students, I'll sit with somebody and they'll make a change and they'll try to go back to the tab where they had their their program. Oh, wait, it's not that one. Okay. Oh no, it's not that one. Oh, here it is. And then refresh. Then go back to the code. Then go back. Oh, wait, what did that Stack Overflow answer say? Then it takes them like 5 seconds to find it. And then it's just like, dude, close all your tabs except the thing you're working on. That's one tab. And then maybe like a Stack Overflow answer, and then immediately when you're done with that, close it. The best number of tabs to have open at once is one tab. Usually people are, you know, 20, 30 tabs on the wrong side of that.
Yeah, I always find it funny because it's like if you close the tab, you can never get it back. But that's what they made Shift Command T for.
Yeah, and even like the vast majority of your tabs, if you have 30 tabs open, are things that you just don't need. You're done with that.
Yep.
Absolute worst case scenario, just Google for that thing and find it again. There's a cost to that, but the cost of that is lower than the mental cost of having all that stuff open.
There is, and sometimes you Google for it again and you find a better answer. I've done that a ton of times.
Yeah, so really, hopefully you're sold. Don't keep all those tabs open. Close your tabs. Okay, Trey, so that's all my tips. Do you have any other tips that you want to add to this, or are we good for now?
The only thing I would say that I see a lot is rushing to fix it. Like a lot of times these bugs, they're in production, they're affecting customers, and there's this big push to fix it. And like you can't rush this process. Like take your time. Diagnose it like a surgeon would diagnose you on the table, and find the root cause and fix the root cause. Like, patch it if you absolutely have to, and you're going to be like fired if you don't get it fixed that day. Otherwise, fix the root cause. Yourself in a year is going to thank you.
Yeah. Yeah, it kind of goes back to like I mentioned earlier, the 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. He has the time matrix in there where there's the urgent and important, the urgent and not important, and so on. And I think what you're saying, Trey, is when you have like a bug in production, it's urgent and important. You need to fix it now. But don't only go so far as to do a superficial patch. Also, if you can spend a little bit of extra time and plug that hole permanently, then that's a much better fix. Is that kind of what you're saying?
Yeah. And I would say, like, you obviously have to balance like the customer pain and not. If the customer's in a lot of pain, patch it, then fix the root cause. Like, you have that option. The trap we fall into, especially in the startup world, is do the simplest thing really fast. But a lot of times we get a little like wishy-washy on what the simplest thing means. And I'm starting to like, I've been working on this a lot recently, is like being able to articulate what that means. And like, it's really like, what is the best thing it possibly could with the simplest solution? And it's still not a very good articulation of it. But for bugs, like patching it, it's like putting duct tape on your window of your car. Like, sure, it's going to keep the rain out, but like the crack's going to get worse. You're going to have to put more duct tape on it later. Eventually your whole window is going to be duct tape and you're not going to be able to see out of it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, fix the customer pain and then fix the crack. Get the window replaced.
Absolutely. I had something to add to that, but it completely escaped me, so I won't. Oh, I just remembered it. There's another saying, yet again, from that 7 Habits book.
It's a very good book.
Really good book. This isn't a programming context in which it was said, of course, but it said, the fast way is slow and the slow way is fast, which is really true in a lot of areas. If you just do the quickest thing you possibly can and toss in some solution, ultimately you're going to get bogged down by all of your band-aid fixes and you're going to have to go slower.
Yep. Exactly.
Trey, where can listeners find out more about you?
Pretty much links to all of my stuff. Like literally everything, Medium, YouTube, all of the things, trobrock.com, TROBROCK.com. There's links to everything there.
Awesome. Well, dear listener, I hope you got a lot out of our programming tips. And Trey, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Yeah. Thanks for having me.